government investigating its own soldiers, that is not an impartial judge. There needs to be these things need to go to the ICC so that they can be viewed impartially. Otherwise, we're going to see the same continually.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantina, author and journalist. Farah Hughes, thank you so much, journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21. Of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Yan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا سواء صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah? They would say, if Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Tehran tells Washington to try to find solutions for its own crises instead of, quote, shedding crocodile tears for the Iranian people. Israeli forces kill another Palestinian youth in a raid on the city of Nablus, increasing the number of Palestinians killed this year to over 220. And also in our headlines, U.S. President Joe Biden reiterates Washington's all-out support for Kiev, stressing that Ukraine will never stand alone in its war with Russia. Our top story for this half hour: Iran has strongly censured the U.S. State Department's interventionist statement on the occasion of Yalta Night, saying the U.S. is, quote, shedding crocodile tears for Iranians. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Washington is the main supporter of riots and terrorism in Iran. He added that the U.S. is the same country that has imposed unilateral sanctions and mounted maximum pressure on the Iranian nation. He advised Western countries that support anti-Iran terrorists to focus on finding solutions for numerous crises that face them and the Israeli regime. The Iranian spokesman was responding to a statement by his American counterpart. In that statement, Ned Price expressed false concern about the current conditions in Iran. He added that the U.S. and its allies will continue their support for the foreign-backed riots in the country. Jordan has hosted the Baghdad 2 summit, which was attended by senior officials from regional countries as well as some European leaders. The summit was aimed at providing support for the stability, security, and prosperity of Iraq, while it also sought to ease tensions in the region. However, bigger question marks are still in place.
Jordan has hosted the second round of the Baghdad Conference for Cooperation and Partnership. with the participation of regional and European countries. According to a statement from the French presidency, which initiated the first round of the dialogue in 2021, the conference aims to provide support for the stability, security, and prosperity of Iraq. Held at King Hussein bin Talal Convention on the eastern shores of the Dead Sea, the Baghdad II summit had a larger number of participating countries than the previous one. The chief motto of the conference was partnership cooperation, how to continue cooperation to support Iraq and its continuity. Leaders and officials from a number of regional countries and organizations, including Iraq, Jordan, Turkey, Egypt, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Oman, Bahrain, and Iran, as well as delegates from France, the European Union, the Arab League, the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the G20, and the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council were in attendance. Oman was not invited to the first round and is a new member of the conference. Syria and Lebanon were not invited to either round. While such broad participation logically testifies to great significance of the event, yet a series of questions about the summit in Jordan remains unanswered. If the conference's title and main mission is regional support for Iraq, as was the case in Baghdad I summit, why has France turned out to be one of the main organizers of this event? If the summit is viewed as a cooperation conference of neighboring countries in support of Iraq, what are the main tasks of outsiders in the meeting and why is Syria excluded then? Damascus is absent from the meeting despite the fact that it is located in the most sensitive part of the region, neighbors Iraq, and shares common threats such as the presence of Daesh terrorists, criminal activities of Takfiri groups, presence of drug trafficking gangs, and numerous border and territorial issues. In addition, how could the Baghdad II summit in Amman be justified in light of Jordan's recent unrest? Some Iraqi analysts and pundits, like director of Iraq's Al-Ittihad Strategic Research Center, have raised similar questions as well.
The Baghdad I summit was held nearly 15 months ago and no tangible results of it have been observed so far. What accounts for such a failure?
At the first conference that featured Mustafa al-Kadhimi's government and Iraq's Arab neighbors, some talk emerged about potential electricity cooperation benefiting Baghdad and potential investment in this area. Such cooperation, however, has failed to materialize so far, and no Arab country has started operating in Iraq towards the purpose.
Addressing the second edition of the Baghdad Conference for Cooperation and Partnership in Jordan, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian called on regional countries to jointly deal with challenges facing West Asia. He also held meetings with other delegations on the sidelines of the summit.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has underscored Tehran's commitment to improving stability and security in West Asia, saying regional security can only be provided by the countries within the strategic region. Amir Abdollahian was addressing the second edition of the Baghdad Conference for the Cooperation and Partnership in Jordan. He also said the Iranian administration has expanded its relations with Iraq's neighboring countries since taking office and underlined support for Baghdad and the government of Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani in order to realize the country's prosperity. The top Iranian diplomat also said the Islamic Republic spared no effort in defending the security in the region as it stood firmly by the government and people of Iraq and Syria against the Takfiri Daesh terrorist group. Elsewhere in his speech, Amir Abdollahian called for a constructive approach for the revival of the 2015 deal by removing the sanctions imposed on Iran.
Iran followed Vienna talks seriously. Today, I would like to thank the representative of the European Union, Mr. Joseph Borrell, for his constructive role during the talks. I told him we demand at all sides to be realistic and that we are ready to reach the last step if our red lines are respected.
In a meeting with EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell, on the sidelines of the conference, Amir Abdollahian called on the other parties to make the necessary political decisions to announce an agreement by avoiding politicization and adopting a constructive approach. Borrell, for his part, emphasized the EU's resolve to advance the Vienna talks and bring them to a conclusion. The Iranian foreign minister also held talks with Saudi foreign minister on the sidelines of the Baghdad 2 summit in Jordan. Amir Abdullahian said his Saudi counterpart has assured him of Riyadh's willingness to resume dialogue with Tehran. The key regional players have already held several rounds of talks mediated by Iraq to settle their differences. Nearly 2 weeks ago, Saudi top diplomat Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud said his country continues to extend its hand to Iran for a positive relationship. Diplomatic relations between the two countries broke off in 2016 after Riyadh executed a prominent Saudi cleric.
Elsewhere, Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian youth during a raid on the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. According to Palestinian media, five other Palestinians were wounded after being hit with live rounds during the raid early Thursday. The Palestinian man has been identified as Ahmed Atif Mustafa Daraghameh, 23 years old, from the city of Tubas. 19 more Palestinians suffered tear gas inhalation injuries. The new fatality increases the number of Palestinians killed this year by Israeli forces to 224, including 53 in the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel's prime minister says he secured a deal to form a new cabinet after weeks of wrangling with his far-right coalition partners. Benjamin Netanyahu made the announcement just minutes before a midnight deadline set by head of the regime, Isaac Herzog. He secured a mandate to form a new cabinet following his November 1st election win. He's now heading the most right-wing coalition in the regime's history. Netanyahu currently faces various corruption charges. He has already served as premier longer than anyone in the regime's history. His election followed a protracted period of political crisis in which Israel saw five general elections in less than 4 years. And thousands of ambulance workers, including paramedics and call handlers, have gone on strike in the UK over pay, increasing pressure on the government today after a similar move by nurses.
It's all we've got to get the government to take notice. So nobody takes this lightly. I've been talking to people inside. Nobody wants to be on strike. We hate it. Like, we don't want patients to suffer. I certainly don't. I'm not withdrawing my labour today, but I thought it's important to stand in solidarity, send the message out. Somebody's got, the government have got to at least talk to people and work out a solution. And they're not even doing that at the moment. I kind of think, just need to open your eyes, system's broken. You can cut it up every way, any way you like. System's broken on every level.
Well, look, every time the health secretary speaks, I've got my head in my hands. I have never seen such an abdication of leadership than I have from Rishi Sunak and the health secretary. We have negotiated, actually, locally, all of the cover. The category ones are all going to be answered. Category two will be triaged. But the important thing to say here is that this government has walked away from the negotiating table. This strike did not need to happen. They need to get back to the negotiating table so we can get a proper pay rise for these workers and everyone can go back to work.
Despite the industrial action, unions said all life-threatening cases will be answered by healthcare workers. Still, the government slammed the strike as deeply regrettable. The strikers demand a pay rise above inflation that rose to a 40-year high of 10.7% last month. The UK has been hit by a wave of strikes as its inflation has fueled the country's cost of living crisis. More strikes are planned by ambulance workers as well as transport workers around Christmas. Earlier, our correspondent Amina Taylor joined us from London to give us more details on the walkouts in the UK, noting that the situation can get worse if the government did not address the strikers' demands.
The NHS, the National Health Service here, has buckled so much under the strain of decades of mismanagement, some of the worst during the last period of Conservative rule. And the government will have to at least sit down and provide a serious counter offer to the 19% that many of them are requesting, because this idea that you're simply not going to negotiate fully or effectively or in good faith and people are supposed to be okay with that, it clearly isn't flying. And these are some of the worst industrial action this country has seen since the days of Margaret Thatcher. And I think if they believe those periods were dark and grim and cold for them and us, I think we're in stage two right now, and it's going to get worse if the government doesn't come to the table properly and address their needs in good faith and to the best of their abilities.
U.S. President Joe Biden has reiterated Washington's pledge to stay with Kiev in its war with Russia, quote, for as long as it takes. Biden made the remark at a joint presser with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House. Biden said Ukraine's fight is part of something much bigger, saying that Kiev will never stand alone in its war with Moscow. He also repeated an earlier announcement by the U.S. State Department about supplying Ukraine with a fresh military aid package. Biden said the new package is aimed at strengthening Kiev's air defense capabilities. The Ukrainian president called the new aid a very important step in boosting his country's air defenses.
The strongest element of this package is the Patriot system. It'll significantly strengthen our air defense. It is an important step in the creation of an effective sky shield for Ukraine.
Earlier on Thursday, the U.S. announced a plan to provide nearly $2 billion in additional military assistance for Ukraine. The new aid includes a Patriot air defense system for the first time since the beginning of the Ukraine war. The Patriot system is considered as one of the most advanced U.S. air defense systems that offers protection against aircraft as well as cruise and ballistic missiles. Russia has time and again warned against such arms delivery, saying they will only prolong the war. Elsewhere, the de facto Taliban government has indefinitely suspended university education for all women in Afghanistan, the latest step in regression against the rights and freedoms of Afghan women. Dramatullah Bahman has more from Kabul.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we've been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
It's difficult to imagine how a country can.
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The head of the World Health Organization expresses great concern over a spike in COVID infections in China, as projections suggest the country could face an explosion of cases and deaths next year. Ghebreyesus also urged China to focus its efforts on vaccinating people at the highest risk, saying the UN Health Agency would support Beijing in the process. The unprecedented COVID surge has overwhelmed hospitals across China. China's zero COVID approach had kept infections and deaths comparatively low, but cases spiked after the government's sudden decision to lift lockdowns, quarantines, and mass testing. Officially, there have been 5,241 COVID-related deaths in China since the start of the pandemic. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Europe got hit by roughly $1 trillion from surging energy costs in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the deepest crisis in decades is only getting started. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, EU member states have spent roughly $1 trillion in the face of the bloc's worst energy crisis in decades, Bloomberg is reporting, citing calculations based on market data. Soaring energy prices have sent its economies plunging into recession as most member states opted to stop importing gas from Russia, facing the necessity to turn to more expensive supplies. The agency highlighted that the total estimated losses marks just the beginning of a full-scale crisis, as a period of high prices for energy could last years, while aid is already becoming unaffordable. The security of energy supply is expected to remain an issue beyond next winter after the filled gas storage facilities across the region are emptied. The nations of the EU will have to refill their gas reserves for the next cold season with no deliveries from Russia, which also heats up competition for tankers. Even with more import terminals for liquefied natural gas LNG coming online, the crisis will reportedly loosen its grip only in 2026, when additional production capacity from the US or Qatar becomes available. At the same time, prices should remain high to attract LNG away from other buyers, from energy-hungry Asian buyers. A state of emergency could linger for years, according to Brussels-based think tank Bruegel, as quoted by Bloomberg. Once you add everything up, bailout subsidies, it is a ridiculously large amount of money, Martin Devenish, a director at consultancy SRM, told the agency, adding it's going to be a lot harder for governments to manage this crisis next year. A rush to fill storage during summer, despite all-time high prices, has softened the supply squeeze so far. However, freezing weather is expected to give the region's energy system the real test this winter. Last month, Germany's energy regulator, the Federal Network Agency, warned that German households and small businesses have failed their first gas-saving test. The regulator noted that a reduction in consumption of at least 20% was required to avoid a gas shortage in the coming months. Meanwhile, Guardian reported the UK is falling far behind EU countries in its performance and policies on home insulation and energy efficiency, and will lose further ground if retained laws from the European Union are scrapped. According to a new study, the report by UK pressure group Another Europe is Possible and Germany's respected Friedrich Ebert Foundation says the UK is failing to match new EU laws which aim to double the annual rate of building renovation and reduce primary energy consumption by 39% by 2030. It says that with UK household electricity prices about 30% higher than its neighbouring EU countries, the UK has a lack of ambition to match such targets, despite the price pressures. An additional threat is posed, it goes on, by the UK government's plan to take thousands of EU laws off the statute book by the end of next year, which will further widen parts of this country. The report's author, David Baldock, senior fellow at the Institute for European Environmental Policy, said, "Our sky-high energy prices mean that we have a clear interest in getting the most out of what we use. But the UK government's energy efficiency and home insulation agenda continues to lack ambition. This is said to be a key area of UK-EU divergence in the years ahead, as the EU commits its member states to bold targets on efficiency and insulation. Divergence is a two-way street. It can mean getting rid of existing EU rules we have inherited from membership. But it can also mean not keeping up with changes the EU is making now. We see both of these happening in UK-EU environmental regulation. Devolution adds another level of complexity because, in different ways, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are all likely to stay closer to EU status quo. Overall, it's a mixed picture with elements of divergence going alongside the expensive duplication of existing EU arrangements without much substantive change. But if the retained EU law bill is not substantially amended, it could see thousands of EU-derived laws taken out of the UK statute book by the end of next year, risking chaos and potentially radical deregulation. The Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy spokesperson said improving the energy efficiency of homes is important to tackling fuel poverty and reducing emissions. And that's why we have committed £6.6 billion this Parliament and a further £6 billion to 2028 to make buildings more energy efficient. The Energy Company Obligation Scheme alone has delivered improvements to around 2.4 million homes, and just last month, we launched our £1 billion Eco Plus scheme to accelerate these efforts, installing measures in households who have previously not been able to access eco support, he said. Recently, the department unveiled a new energy efficiency campaign to help people reduce usage and bills.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Football in the media. Over 400 years have passed since the first newspaper was printed in the history of mankind. Now, newspapers have become something very ordinary in our daily lives. Even if we don't buy it, sometimes we stand by the newsstand and take a look at the headlines and the pictures. Every day, over 300 million copies of newspapers are sold throughout the world. Political, cultural, ideological, and yellow press, and those about the minorities, and of course, sports newspapers. Who can deny that the largest numbers of issues are for sports newspapers? Seeing a football player's picture and a controversial headline on the front page of a newspaper will tempt anyone to buy a copy of it. It's true, most of the analysis and news items in sports dailies are about football. But the story isn't that simple. Now there are millions of sites on the internet that are about football news and analysis. From the sites that cover the news about a club or even a player to credible sites that have a 500,000 visitors every day. Yes, we have to add television and radio programs to all of them. It seems football is the most important event in the world. It doesn't look like anyone or anything can draw the attention of the media as much as football. July 13th, 2014, the biggest failure of legendary Lionel Messi, the unforgettable final match in Brazil. Germans got lucky in injury time.
Philipp Lahm will lift that trophy.
The majestic championship of the disciplined German team.
Germany, deserved champions of the world.
Over 1 billion people were watching the game live, and almost all reputable media in the world had no other schedule other than covering the final match in the World Cup. During those moments, Israel carried out the fifth day of its attacks on Gaza. That day, when all of the media were busy predicting the World Cup champions, the Israeli army shelled 173 locations in the Gaza Strip. They killed 13 Palestinians.
Press waiting, as we all are, for the arrival of the two teams.
But the media couldn't stay away from football, and it had a clear reason: money. Football is so attractive that millions of people will sit in front of the TV to watch it. The live coverage, news, the sideline issues, analysis, and even technical charts, they make the job much easier. The money paid for buying a newspaper, the money television stations earn from the advertisement during the halftime, and of course, the money the websites on football earn. The media are economic corporations before anything else. Money directs everything. A news report about a bombing in Pakistan or civil war in Sudan cannot gather even an iota of the audience of a football match. That's why football has turned into the most important preoccupation of the media. Well, at least that's the case during the World Cup games. During the days of the World Cup games are being held, media representatives are everywhere, filming on the sidelines, taking pictures or conducting interviews, reporting the games in many languages on the seats, preparing their reports in media halls, shouting in press conferences, following the players and coaches, filming the fans, or preparing reports about the beauties of the host country. A significant part of what we know as the World Cup is made by the reporters. That's why everyone loves to be seen in the media. Great politicians watch the games and show reactions so they'll be noticed by the media. The spectators put on bizarre appearances so they'll be seen in the media, and the players try to find a place in the frames of the media with their strange faces or behaviors. Media are the secret of becoming visible. Becoming visible is a prelude to fame, and fame means wealth and, of course, power. The focus on the World Cup starts from months earlier. We get bombarded by the media from months earlier. Well, to be honest, this is one of the reasons why we care so much about the World Cup. They've told us for months earlier that something really big is going to happen. It's a principle. Before something turns into a hot topic for the media, it has to be dramatized. It has to turn into an interesting story and needs to be elaborated in a way that even its title can draw the audience to the media to follow the news or report. The dramatization has different shapes. Confrontation between Argentina and England a few years after the Falkland War, the clash between Zidane and Materazzi, Maradona's doping, the Boateng brothers playing for two national teams, or even the strike by the French players in the 2010 World Cup. All of these stories were big enough, but the media's heavy focus on them and the explosion of news stories and different analysis turned them into a part of our memory. And we follow the narrative presented by the media about the World Cup, a narrative that has many flaws. When the raging Colombian fans fired bullets at Andre Escobar, no one thought about the role of the biting sports news analysis in Colombia in provoking the assassins. When, in the 1982 World Cup, the German and Austrian players fixed the outcome and walked on the field so Algeria won't move on to the next stage, the world media didn't shed ample light on the issue. When Brazilian workers were standing outside the stadiums while the games were being played and were warning of the high cost of hosting the World Cup, many media censured them. Political interests, radical nationalism, and economic interests will all affect the media coverage of the World Cup. There's no such thing as impartial media. Billions of people who follow the World Cup care about what their favorite teams or players do. They're after excitement, happiness, tears, and joy. They rarely think about the media and about the hidden interests and directions behind the media and how the media makes some things look outstanding and how they remove some other things from the scene. And how they turn it into a show, something that can attract advertisement, something that can be sold, something that can make the players, teams, or a certain country more popular. This is a shocking reality. We don't see the reality of the World Cup, we see the World Cup made by the media. But the story hasn't always been like this. Reporters found out about the miraculous power of the World Cup from the very start. It was a venue where representatives of a country would fight with the representatives of another country. You only had to provoke a little the national sentiments of the people to come to your newspaper to see what the representatives of their proud country have done. In the first World Cups, when the technology wasn't advanced enough to extend television coverage to a large number of people, the newspapers had the prime role in spreading the news. Besides that, radio also existed. Radio in different countries would gather thousands of people. People would listen to the reporters and would use their imagination to see what their champions were doing on the field. The reports and nationalist analysis would go as far as creating a catastrophe.
Good evening. The game you're about to see is the most stupid, appalling, disgusting, and disgraceful exhibition of football possibly in the history of the game. Chile versus Italy. This is the first time the two countries have met. We hope it will be the last.
For example, the newspapers in Chile and Italy before the two teams' games in 1962 launched a smear campaign against the rival team's nation and turned their game into a crazy and violent battle replete with punches, kicks, and red cards.
Well, this looks like turning into a real battle. And what a scene after just 5 minutes play.
Or after the match between Argentina and England in the 1966 World Cup, Alf Ramsey said, "We're not used to training our players to act as animals.
We have still to produce our best, and this best is not possible until we meet the right type of opposition. That is a team that comes out to play football and not act as animals."
The Argentine newspapers quoted him as saying, "Argentine people are animals." 4 years later in Mexico, South American reporters treated the English coach in the worst possible manner. But it wasn't the only impact of the media on the World Cup. First time television networks implemented the technology to broadcast the World Cup live, they convinced the officials in charge of holding the 1970 World Cup told the competition 12 at noon sharp under scorching heat. The amount of money paid to receive the viewership was so high that it would convince the FIFA officials to ignore the quality of the games. The viewership affected the next World Cup games as well, when the U.S. was granted the right to host the 1994 World Cup, while Brazil and Morocco were more qualified to host the games. Now, football was broadcast live in all countries.
Hurst shoots against the bar. A goal or no? He asks his Russian linesman. And the linesmen say yes.
For example, in the 1966 World Cup, people in England would listen to the radio report on suspicious Jeff Hurst goal against Germany or Bobby Charlton's extraordinary goal against Mexico, and would read the report in newspapers and finally could see the video on TV. Nowadays, everyone in the world can see the dribbles by Maradona, or goals by Salvatore Schillaci, or tackles by Lothar Matthäus real time. Sometimes they can even see things from the future, like the advertisement on Yahoo during the 1944 World Cup, when 99% of the people in the world knew nothing about the internet. The television coverage reached from the first odd cameras to spider cameras and flying cameras. The reporters reached from the telegraph, telephones, and pens to real-time reporting via the internet. The cameras of the photographers also went through major changes, but none of them affected the World Cup as much as the biggest modern media, the internet, and social media. July 13th, 2014, the final match. Over 32 million tweets were posted on social media about the football match. Facebook had over 280 million posts, comments, and likes. The number of news items and pictures on Instagram wasn't any less. It means the end of the 80-year domination of the media on the World Cup. Nowadays, every player, coach, reporter, analyst, referee, or fan is a media on their own. Now, billions of people are simultaneously both the media and the audience. Maybe it's diminished only a part of the powerful visual, print, and internet media. This is behind the scenes of what we see in the World Cup. Based on their tastes and interests, the media show part of the World Cup to us. They take small and big stories out of it, they attract us, they earn money, and the passion and excitement by the media have turned football and the World Cup into the most prevalent an influential phenomenon in today's world. This time around, we can watch it a little deeper. Maybe we can see the real picture of the World Cup through the different curtain various media have covered it with. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
In the limelight.
U.S. authorities have claimed the war in Ukraine will continue for as long as they want and they will provide military assistance to Ukraine. But many experts are saying America's arsenals of weapons and munitions are running low. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website of Foreign Policy writes, as the conflict in Ukraine shows little sign of abating, Kiev's Western partners are grappling with how to maintain a supply of arms and ammunition to Ukraine without letting their stockpiles dwindle to the point that it could jeopardize their own readiness levels. A NATO official who spoke on condition of anonymity said, I think everyone is now sufficiently worried, adding, the Allies had called on Western defense contractors to ramp up production in the wake of the conflict in Ukraine. The relevance of stockpiling is back. The official said NATO is now discussing how to support member states if their stockpiles fall below the levels needed to meet their war obligations under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Although decisions around military aid to Ukraine fall to individual members of the alliance, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has repeatedly spoken about the need for continued armed delivery to Ukraine. Jeb Nadana, a former U.S. Supply Assistant Secretary of Defense for Industrial Policy during the Trump administration, said, even if there wasn't the Ukrainian fight, our stockpiles are still too low. You don't have to invent the weapons of the 22nd century to do this, but the industry will need a stable demand signal. Behind the scenes, the United States and other NATO countries have urged Western defense companies to bump up production. However, current and former officials and analysts said defense contractors have been slow to respond as they wait for assurances that the era of an increased arms appetite is here to stay. Mark Kansian, who served as chief of Pentagon's Force Structure and Investment Division until 2015, said, "What they say is essentially show me the money. Their fear is that the war will end and the orders will end and they will end up with these expanded factories that don't have any orders to fill them. Contributing to bottlenecks in production are rising prices of critical raw materials and a shortage of skilled labor." In mainland Europe, where military aid to Ukraine is being dwarfed by the United States and some countries, such as Germany, are still reluctant to dust off old tanks to send to Ukraine. Leaders do not want a mobilization that would put the defense industry back on a seemingly war footing. And skilled workers, high school trained technicians, designers, and safety and environmental experts are often reluctant to bring their talents to the defense industry, fearing that they could be first on the chopping block in any downturn. In an all-out artillery war with the Russians that has lasted almost since the Kremlin declared its operation in the Donbas region in April, Ukraine has practically run itself out of Soviet standard artillery, which comprises about 60% of their arsenal, forcing Kiev to rely more heavily on NATO standard artillery that can't be produced fast enough to sustain the fight. CNN has also covered the same story. Concern is growing in the U.S. government about its ability to keep supplying Ukraine with state-of-the-art systems and ammunition amid its ongoing conflict with Russia.